Welcome into this week's edition of AWA Unleashed. My name is Chris Tubbs, as you can see on the screen. We are talking AWA. We are the preeminent AWA stream slash podcast. And that being said, let's jump right into it. I'm going to bring in Mick Karch and George Shire. Go ahead and put you guys up on the screen. Before we get into it, last week's enhancement talent, a lot of people loved it. You know, I think people enjoyed hearing a lot of the names that they hadn't heard, or it's like, oh, I remember that person. So I think you guys hit on a winner last week.
I loved it. I love doing it. And when you get an email or a text from Nacho Barrera, and yeah, he said, thank you so much for mentioning my name. And, you know, I loved it, brother. That's what it's all about. So very happy that we got positive, mostly positive response.
And hey, I had a texter tell me that they liked my Herman Schaefer crater comment. And I told him in a response, I said, I neglected to say that's where Vern had the midgets stay when they were in town.
Oh, my God.
Well, we've got a lot of things we got to get to, but I do, before we get to that, I did have a, I never weighed in on my thoughts on the greatest jobbers in the history of the AWA, and I'm just going to throw that out there.
Oh my God.
Is my take for the greatest jobbers, enhancement talent that ever graced the presence of the AWA.
There, so, you're witnessing Karch having another of his dizzy spells.
So
there you are witnessing me attempting to endure 30 seconds of your diatribe, George Shire.
You look at my face. It's asking, you know, what the hell are you doing now? Oh, man.
Those were the best you could find, huh, Chris?
You know, hey, I got one you could find.
Well, no, it's got to be edited, though, George. I mean, we're still. Yeah, I mean, we're not FCC regulated here, but I mean, we got to keep it clean for the kids.
Kayfabe it, George. Will you please?
Kayfabe it.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, let's get into this week. But before we do, let's go ahead and get into the trivia winner from last week, Mick.
All right. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Is it Larry Slobotny?
That is correct.
So, and the question, of course, last week was to name the wrestler that had vegetables tossed at him by the Crusher on television as a way to kind of antagonize him and build up their feud. And why did Crusher choose the route of throwing tomatoes and lettuce and what have you? It was Killer Kowalski, and Walter Kowalski, was a vegetarian and an outspoken vegetarian. So Crusher, of course, picked his weak spot and decided he would throw tomatoes at him, might have thrown a cucumber, I don't know. But congratulations, Larry. I'll send you a picture of George Shire for your efforts.
And I think Larry would enjoy that. I've talked with him. He's a great guy.
I'm going to say, you send something to Shire, we're going to lose a listener and a viewer. Who knows?
No, Chris is turning on me.
I'm not turning. I'm just, you know, that's what the kids are talking about. That's what the kids are talking about. Hey, so today it's all about Crusher and Bruiser. And before we get to that, I know that you guys, we lost a couple of performers this week. And why don't you go ahead and start, Mick?
Very, very saddened about this. Candy Devine, her real name was Candace Rummel. She was the AWA Ladies Champion back in the 1980s, been around the business for a long, long time. Just a sweet gal. There she is. Candy has had a couple of really tough years physically, had some seizure issues, fell several times, and unfortunately she passed just the other day, 63 years old. I was first introduced to Candy in the 1980s by Sherry Martel when she was in the AWA. And just a wonderful gal, and she will be sorely missed. Way too young to be passing.
Your thoughts on that, George?
Well, Candy Devine, I can't say any more than Mick did. I think he really summed it up. Just a sweet lady, and it's sad. I was going to bring up, we lost another, ties right in with our jobber episode last week, we lost Ricky Hunter, who was a jobber in the AWA, but he was a star everywhere else. And he passed away this past February 8th, a few days ago, and at the age of 85. But in the AWA, he always was a star that looked like he could do the whole thing. He was kind of a Billy Robinson type wrestler. He was the real deal. He was started a little bit by Vern Gagne. Some people didn't know this, but it was Vern that originally started him. He was from Winnipeg, Canada, and Vern sent him out to Portland, Oregon to work with Don Owen. And he was wrestling at the time as Buddy Sprott. That was his real name, Charles Sprott. And Owen changed it to Ricky Hunter. He says, Sprott sounds like a disease, so we're going to call you Ricky Hunter. A true story. And he became Ricky Hunter and then had a great success in California and also went out to Florida, down to Florida, and wrestled under a mask as the Gladiator, was Florida champion. Mm-hmm. And when he'd come into the AWA, he would job. But he gave us credibility in the AWA, and it was sad to see him pass the other day.
So RIP to Candy Devine and Ricky Hunter. And, yeah, they definitely – I mean, I see the posts all the time about, you know, just about the impact that they made. So it's, you know, it's unfortunate. Let's move on to Crusher and the Bruiser this week, guys. And I think really it's really fascinating because, you know, nasty heels, you know, just great baby faces. But I want to get into it in terms of the popularity, guys. This is for both of you. In terms of popularity with the fans, it seemed like Crusher was more over in certain cities, Bruiser in others. Was that fair to say?
I'm not sure it would be fair to say that. It's just the time they spent in the particular territories when they were in them. Crusher was more AWA. Bruiser was more WWA and across other territories as well. But individually, both were extremely hated and then popular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that too. You know, Bruiser spent a lot of time in the Indianapolis area and then, of course, into Chicago. So he was tremendously popular there. Crusher, of course, owned the AWA as a babyface for many, many years. So between the two of them, just incredibly popular. And like you said, Chris, they made that transition from the hated villain heel to babyface flawlessly and legendary.
Yeah, you know, I'll go ahead, George.
Well, I was just going to say the one thing I'd say about the flawlessly if they're changing from baby to heel or heel to baby. The Crusher, when he came to the AWA in 62, I don't think there had been, other than maybe Gene Kaniski, well, Bill Miller too, but other than those two guys that were as hated and as much of a bully. The Crusher was a bully, and there was no comedy in his act. He would come into the ring. He would maul his opponents. He had two finishing holds. Well, this was way back. This goes back to when he was Reggie Lisowski in the 50s. And, you know, he was a bad guy then. You know, I should say he had a couple tag team stints as Reggie Lisowski with his wrestling brother, Stan. And he also teamed with Art Nielsen, and they were recognized as champions. But it was when he became the Crusher on his own that he drew the crowds as a heel. And he was hated. He had two finishing holds that really caused a lot of stir. The old Full Nelson. Crusher called it the Crusher Nelson, and he would put it around his opponent's back in the neck, and he would put on the pressure, and the referee couldn't get him to break it, and he'd have the guy pass out, and Crusher would claim that he put on the pressure, his fingers would swell up, and he couldn't release the hold. Well, he also had a stomach claw, and he put that claw into the guy's gut, and he would squeeze and squeeze, and again, he couldn't break it because his fingers swelled up. So a lot of disqualifications.
That's always amazed me about Crusher on the stomach claw. Yeah. I can understand not being able to release the Full Nelson because your fingers swell. But if you got your fingers in a guy's stomach and your fingers swell up, just pick your hands up. I'm guessing that would probably release the hold.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that we're going to just jump ahead just a bit. When he became a comedy character, he didn't use either of those dastardly holds anymore. He was now using the bolo punch.
Why don't you wait until I get to that question a little bit later on, the next time you look at a script before we go on the air?
Hey, I'm just throwing it out there that you want to talk about something he could have done that looked more real. The bolo punch didn't do it.
So you talked about, you know,
had a script.
So we talked about, you know, or you guys talked about being hated and, you know, also being baby faces. I've seen comparisons to the Road Warriors. Is that fair to put those guys and the Road Warriors in the same comparison? Maybe in terms of, I don't know if it's, you know, just because they're badasses that could kick people's asses or babyface heels. I mean, do you see comparisons between the two of them? Go ahead, Mick.
Yeah, there's definitely comparisons between the two tag teams. I mean, you're talking different eras. The Road Warriors came up in an era where everything was already glitz and glamour, and they were two big, huge muscle guys. And of course, they had the spiked outfits and what have you. Where Crusher and Bruiser were more the working man type heel, you know, that worked out with the beers and what have you. Yeah, two different eras, but definitely I would say badasses, both of them. And I think that's probably where the comparison ends. Because the Road Warriors, you know, they were what they were. They were tremendous, and they would, you know, maybe give you 10, 15-minute matches. Crusher and Bruiser sometimes would go 45 minutes, an hour, what have you. But definitely, you know, of the same ilk, as far as who was the toughest of the two, I think in the heyday, Crusher and Bruiser probably would not take a back step to the Road Warriors. I'm just guessing about that.
Well, and I think a fantasy match would have been the Crusher and Bruiser in their primes against the Road Warriors in their primes. That would have been main event, as Marty would say, anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
All right. This one's for you, George, from Rich Tito of Chicago. How did Vern ever agree to let them hold the belts their last time after they beat Nick Bockwinkel and Ray Stevens in 75? That Vern had to know that Bruiser appeared regularly in Kansas City, St. Louis, and Detroit, plus his own WWA. They seem to hardly appear in Minnesota as a team, and then got into Chicago.
Well, I think the key word in that question, Rich, is it wasn't why did Vern let them win? And he did know, of course he knew. Mm-hmm. The idea was is that they were taking the title off of Nick and Ray because Nick was being prepped to take over for Vern in a few months. And, you know, shortly after. And so put Crusher with Bruiser, let him win the title. The deal with Crusher, and we'll discuss this probably as we go on here, Crusher wasn't always teamed with Bruiser in the AWA, but when they were champions, he could team with other guys and claim, I don't need to bring Bruiser in. And it all worked well to build the feud. And then when Bruiser would come back, it popped. So it wasn't that, you know, Vern knew this, it was all done on purpose, and it wasn't intended that Bruiser would be in defending.
Kind of piggybacking on that, Chris, back in the day, it wasn't like you have today where there's a champion defending his title and there's a title switch every week and a half. It wasn't that way. You know, people get on Brock Lesnar because he only makes 15 appearances or whatever a year. But back in the 60s and the 70s, a champion coming in to defend his title was a real attraction. It wasn't a regular thing. Mm-hmm. So Crusher and Bruiser may have come into town in the AWA in Minneapolis, maybe 5-6 times a year, maybe. Vern would defend his title maybe 10-12 times a year. So completely different eras, and I think that just kind of speaks to how Vern could let Bruiser and Crusher have the title.
But another one for you here, George, from Benny Ramirez. What's the story you've told about Crusher's reluctance to sign his name, Reggie Lazowski, on memorabilia?
Well, I actually had a chance where I wanted Reggie Lazowski to sign Reggie Lazowski on a Reggie Lazowski picture. And Crusher didn't want to do it. The story behind that is that Crusher, for some reason, after he switched over, you know, from being under his own name, he didn't appreciate his years in the business. He didn't speak highly of Reggie Lazowski. He didn't really care for the tag teams that he was in. He did so well with them, but he didn't really embellish them. And it was the Crusher that he was. And so on a Reggie Lazowski photo, he signed the Crusher. And, you know, in my period correct type situation, that doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. A funny story with that. On your radio station, Chris, back in the late 70s, there was a night host named Jim Rogers. And he had on the air with him, he brought in the Crusher as a guest, and they were taking phone calls. And a fan called in and asked Crusher, he said, "Crusher, what is your first name?" Without missing a beat, he said, "The." And Jim Rogers, he was laughing loudly on the air.
And those are the stories that I think are just are so cool to hear, where you think so quickly on your feet too, because I'm sure back then, you know, information wasn't as accessible. Kind of to sidebar off of that, were there times back then, guys, where maybe fans would want to get to know a little bit more about the wrestlers themselves instead of just who they are in the ring or whatever their character persona was?
I think that is the case, but it wasn't going to happen, Chris. They were larger than life characters, the wrestlers. Everything was totally kayfabe. You could want to know a wrestler personally. Every once in a while, there would be a magazine article or something about a wrestler's home life or what he did for recreation or what have you. But for the most part, their on-screen persona was really protected. And, we know where that's gone. So,
yeah. All right. Here's one for you, Mick. Let me get down to it here. From Scott Robinson, who says, "I own a wrestling magazine from 1965 and it lists your fan club for the Crusher. Now, who knew and how did that come about?"
1965, when I had just turned, I must have just turned 2 or 3 years old back then.
Now he's lying.
I wanted to start a fan club. I would read in the wrestling magazines about all these various fan clubs for the honoraries around the country, and I decided I wanted to start one for the Crusher. And as a matter of fact, I believe it's the January 1965 edition of Wrestling Illustrated magazine. There is a little blurb in there. I had provided the permission slip and talked to Crusher, actually, in the lobby of the Dyckman Hotel. And I remember the conversation vividly because I asked Crusher if I could start a fan club for him, and Crusher said, "Yeah, I don't care." So that was the extent of that conversation. And then I think the next time I talked to Crusher about the club, I asked him if he had gotten the bulletin that I had sent to the wrestling office, and he said, "Yeah, I haven't finished reading it yet." So that was pretty much my entire association with Crusher. He didn't see a bulletin. He didn't know who I was from anything, but that was actually my first foray into wrestling fan clubs.
I want to ask you, George, got one here from Bobby Mitchell. How was Dick the Bruiser as a promoter?
Well, that's a question where it depends on who you ask and when you ask it. But I think if you want to be fair about it, Dick the Bruiser as a promoter ran a territory that next to the big three, WWF, AWA, NWA, was probably next in line for being one of the best promotions in the business at the time. And another who's who of talent that came through, and Bruiser had all of the credentials to bring them in and feud with them. He and his territory was like the Crusher in our territory, the AWA. He was the star. He was over. He was the main event. And a lot of the boys that worked with him, they'd have their issues. They didn't like a payday they got or something like that. This is Crusher wearing the Missouri championship belt. And a little bit later on in his career, you noticed he's got his locks growing out there a little bit. He was in the perm era. He'd start getting perms. But Dick the Bruiser was, like I said, it depends on who you ask. And it's the old story. Not every wrestler was going to be happy no matter what.
Let's move on here because we still got a ton of these questions here. I mean, people love – why do you think they were so beloved? I mean, why do you think that people just – out of all the people that we talk about, I mean, Crusher and Bruiser, they're always intertwined. Why is that, you guys? I know this isn't one of the questions, but it just kind of got me thinking. Why do people just – look at them so fondly? Was it because they were like the prototypical wrestler, like the baddest, the guy that could really like beat you up, and you were like legitimately concerned that this is a guy that could, you believed that these Bruiser and Crusher, you really believed that they were able to bruise you and crush you?
I think, Chris, it's a two-pronged thing. First of all, it was the working man situation again. There was nothing fancy about Crusher and Bruiser. They just came to the ring and kicked the shit out of you. I mean, basically is what it was. And then, and we know that they were hated at one time, but once they turned babyface, the AWA or WWA would establish heels in their own territories, and the heels would be running roughshod through everybody, and the call would always go out eventually to Crusher and Bruiser to come into the territory and clean up the bad guys. And that's what they did. That's where the fans developed the love affair, and they could identify with them. You know, the guys drink beer, you know, they're at the bar, they're sitting there, you know, smoking cigars and beating people up. And it was enduring, and it was a love affair for many, many years.
Well, let's get right into that then, because this seems to kind of be where it is right now. Crusher and Bruiser, two guys that made that transition from hated heels to baby faces. Who do you think was better in each of those roles? Let's go ahead and George, why don't you start this one?
That's a great question too. And I'm going to piggyback a little bit on what Mick said. You know what made Crusher and Bruiser so popular when they made that transition? I think you have to give credit to the promotion in how they got there. You know, the Crusher and the Bruiser were originally put together by Vern. And that's when the Crusher and Bruiser discovered they were cousins, working cousins. But what happened was the Crusher was involved in a major program with Vern Gagne. And I told you how bullyish and how mean and hated Crusher was. Well, he ended up losing a loser leave town match. Now, in those days, it was loser leave the AWA, but they just said town in the particular city they were in. Crusher lost and he disappeared for 3, 4, 5 months. Nobody knew where he was, but he still held the title with the Bruiser. Well, the weird part is that Hennig and Race were being built up as the greatest heel team, and they wanted a chance at the championship. They got involved in a feud against Vern Gagne and Reggie Parks, and Wilbur Snyder had interfered in that match with Hennig and Race. So Hennig and Race said, we're going to get revenge. We're going to bring in a partner. They surprised everyone, and they brought in the Bruiser in 1964. And the Bruiser comes in, and he turns against Hennig and Race in that match because they weren't tagging him in and out enough. Hennig and Race were doing the fast tags and eliminating Bruiser. So he went in and put their heads together, gave them a migraine, and went home. Hennig and Race were livid. We want Bruiser, Benedict Arnold, you know. And Bruiser said, they want me. I'm going to search all the honky-tonks, all the bars in Milwaukee, and I'm going to find the Crusher. Now, until 5 months ago, Crusher's not existent. So when the Crusher came back in 1965, that's when we had that transition and the promotion up to it. So Bruiser and Crusher were the fan favorites in that match. And then the great opponents that Hennig and Race were, that just piggybacked on for Crusher and Bruiser, and their feud for the next 4 years is legendary. And I think that's how you have to say how they got over.
One thing I would add to that, George, maybe you know the history on this. I believe when Crusher took the time off back then, his dad had died, I believe, in the summer of 1964. So Crusher wanted to take time off. So again, like George said, he was gone 5, 6 months. When he came back, this really was a huge deal, Chris. The promotion took out an advertisement in the TV section of the newspaper with a picture of Crusher that said, Crusher is back. So they were going above and beyond just advertising on All Star Wrestling, and the rest is history.
You know, and I'd like to point out too, is that during the time that the Crusher was gone for that 4 months, there was a local Twin Cities band who came out with the Crusher, do the Crusher, the Novas. They were a garage band. And if you heard the song, it sounded like the Crusher was singing it. Do the turkey neck, you hammer, or do the hammerlock, you turkey neck. And it became very popular on KDWB and WDGY, the rock stations at the time. So during that absence, that wasn't part of it. The Novas just hit it lucky and it just worked into the play. But when the Crusher came back, and against Hennig and Race with the Bruiser, they were automatically the good guys.
And there's and then, the and there's a picture of the record itself, the vinyl, as the kids would say.
45, and it was big. It was played big time here in the Twin City market.
And by the way, for those that are like listening, you can hear that song underneath you. If you're on YouTube, unfortunately, you're not going to be able to see it because of, you know, copyrights and all that. But if you're listening to the audio podcast, we do have that playing a little bit underneath us. Do have one for you, Mick, from Randy Schoberg. And he writes, I remember seeing a lot of the AWA legends on Saturday night at ringside and was curious why Crusher and Bruiser never appeared on the show. I think that's a good question.
Bruiser was kind of unreachable at the time. He was doing his own thing. And as I'm putting together this Saturday night at ringside special, for example, I wanted to get the wrestlers that were accessible. Maybe they were within the five-state area or whatever, who could come in. And Al DeRusha of the AWA was very good friends with the Crusher. And I actually asked Al, can you send out a message to Crusher, explain what we're doing? We're having some of the legends, Butch Levy, Leo Namely, you know, Vern Gagne, you know, blah, blah, blah. We're talking about whoever we could get. And what Al told me is that Crusher had already kind of taken a back step from the wrestling business. And because he was getting older and he wasn't quite the Crusher of old, if you can believe this, he was starting to shy away from public appearances, which is really too bad, because when you're a legend, people don't care, you know, if you've lost a ton of weight or what have you. But Crusher had decided he wanted to always be the rough, tough Crusher. And the edge was starting to come off a little bit. And he was in Milwaukee. He could have made the trip, but he just didn't feel like he was the Crusher anymore, which is sad. I would love to have had him on the show, obviously.
Got another one here from this one's for you, George. Actually, for both of you, from Jim Taylor. Got a question. They were local legends. Did they have any good instances with celebrities? And then I've got a couple follow up that Jim's got. But how did they interact with other celebrities outside of wrestling business? Go ahead, and I'll let you start this, George.
I'll just say that the Bruiser probably had more celebrity status than Crusher did. Bruiser was out in California for a stint. And I have a picture in my collection. He hobnobbed with Jane Mansfield. And there were other celebrities that he was around. So the Hollywood said Bruiser had a little bit more. That would be the only one that I know. I don't recall that Crusher was really, you know, Mick pointed out that the Crusher later on became more of a shying away. And to be honest with you, the Crusher really was a lot like that during his career. He didn't do a lot with the fans or want to be around the fans. I think he lived his business and that's all he wanted. And it wasn't that he was ungrateful or anything. He knew what he was doing. But that would be my answer. Jane Mansfield is the one that comes to mind. And I have a photo of them together, the Bruiser and her. In fact, they're out having drinks together.
I agree with that about Crusher, too. Crusher was really a family man. He was very, very devoted to his wife, Faye. And he stayed close to home. He stayed in Milwaukee, the south side of Milwaukee. And I'm like George, I can't remember any time. There's actually a picture of the Crusher and his wife, Faye. And that was, you know, towards the end, sadly, for both of them. But they were so devoted to each other. And Crusher had his son Larry, of course, who refereed in the AWA, and then he had a daughter as well. Crusher was a family man. People, you know, you see this persona on television, this loud, boisterous Crusher Lasowski. There's Crusher and his daughter. I mean, what a tremendous picture that is, and that really exemplified.
Yeah, I love that. I love that picture from.
Isn't that
something? Because we've all got daughters, and you see that connection between father and daughter, and it instantly tugs at you and it humanizes him.
The more I hear about Crusher from people in the business, the more I realize this was the guy. I mean, this is who was in that picture. loved his family, loved to stay home, loved Milwaukee, very devoted to that neck of the woods. So, yeah, Bruiser was kind of hobnobbing every once in a while with a celebrity, but not so much for Crusher.
You know, I'd also add with the Crusher and his popularity, he understood that he was popular. He understood that he drew money, and he understood that Vern in the AWA would come to him often to take a spot when attendance was down or whatever. And the one thing a lot of fans don't know, I hear fans all the time say, well, you know, why wasn't Crusher champion, AWA champion, or how come he didn't beat Nick and he was so popular? The reality and the truth of it is that Crusher never wanted to be the champion or even the tag team champion. Every time he did it as a favor to Vern in a situation. And I don't know if we'll have time to go into any of those, but we can explore them. But he did hold the AWA world title three times. But in the scheme of things, they were only for 3 months and 4 weeks total time. 2 weeks the first time, 2 weeks the second time, and then 3 months. And that was in the 60s when he was battling Vern, and he was also battling the Mad Dog. And it was done, they gave him the title only to build up rematches.
And you see that photograph that you just put up there on the screen, Chris. That, of course, is in the south side of Milwaukee, mm-hmm. The Crusher statue, which sadly was up for probably about a month, and it was vandalized by some teenagers. The local community got together and raised funds to put that statue up for Crusher. So I believe they've enhanced it since then. But this guy was the real deal in Milwaukee. I mean, he was as much of a cult hero as anybody from any, you know, hometown where the people identify with him, and they called him the wrestler that made Milwaukee famous.
Yes.
And man, I'll tell you, and there it is. Not many wrestlers can boast of having a statue of themselves in their own hometown. They have a Crusher Fest every year. Some of the wrestlers get involved, and, you know, it's a beer drinking fest and what have you. So Crusher is gone, but not forgotten, certainly in Milwaukee.
I've got one here for both of you guys, because George, you mentioned the instance with Mad Dog Vachon. This coming from Dean Marquardt, what do you guys remember about that bloody incident between Crusher and Mad Dog, and Roger Kent going bananas because Dog was seriously hurt?
It was a match, or it wasn't a match on television. The Crusher had gotten involved in a skirmish with the Dog, and tossed the Dog out of the ring. Crusher's beating up on the Dog. Well, Crusher, I don't know if he was not aware that the Dog was bleeding at the time. He's on the floor, he's outside the ring, and Crusher's kind of putting the boots to him. Well, in the midst of this going on, Mad Dog hit an artery with the blade, and Crusher tossed him back into the ring. And I for the life of me, I still don't understand, because the blood is just spurting all over, and Crusher's mm-hmm. continuing to hammer on the cut even when they went back in the ring. But Roger Kent at ringside knew exactly how serious this was. And in the midst of all this chaos, Roger Kent is basically pleading for somebody to get some pressure on the Mad Dog's cut, because it was like a squirt gun. I mean, this guy was just, he was going to, you know, go into blood loss shock or something. And the Dog actually did go to the hospital, and I believe he got 26 some stitches. It's on YouTube. You can see it. But Roger Kent was absolutely frantic. He knew that this had gone wrong.
And this was one of those matches that took place at the TV studio at the Calhoun Beach Hotel. And the Crusher was coming back to the AWA after another four-month absence. He had lost the title with the Bruiser to the Vachons in August of 69. And in 1970, he was coming back, and he's going to get, you know, back at the Vachons to get the title. That's the story. He had beaten Butcher in a singles match in a previous week. And then during the studio match with the Dog getting involved there, Dog and Butcher were beating up on a couple of guys, and the Crusher came out in his street clothes and started interfering. So that incident became very famous. But Mick is right. He went to the hospital, and he actually, Mad Dog did not wrestle the live auditorium show that night. He was scheduled to go against Crusher in the main event. And because Dog couldn't wrestle, they changed the main event and had Crusher team with Edouard Carpentier against Larry Hennig and Lars Anderson. And it was a complete they had to change on the come, so to speak.
Wow. I mean, did when did people know that that dog was really hurt? Did they could they tell like during the match, or was, I mean, did Roger, did he immediately knew that something was wrong?
Roger knew immediately, you know, and again, you're back in an era, Chris, where everybody believed what they were seeing anyway. And, you know, the notion of how a wrestler bled was not out there yet. And I mean, this was just an error on Crusher's part. I mean, you know, obviously it's not intentional. And, you know, Dog was on the floor and he was bleeding and Crusher kicked him. And obviously, you know, at that point, the blade went in a little bit too far. But people seem to kind of be going their own business, but Kent knew, and it was like he was all of a sudden he was out of character because he literally is screaming like for Officer Bob O'Brien, the AWA's head of security, get in there, get some pressure on that. You know, this man is in serious trouble. And it was obvious. That's why I say I'm very surprised that Crusher continued to work on the cut, even though they were back in the ring, because this was a no-brainer. The dog was in trouble.
The real plus to this thing was is that this continued to really explode the feud between the Dog and the Crusher. They had done this in the mid-60s, led up to a cage match. Now they were able to do it again in the early 70s. And their matches across the AWA, I mean, sellouts all over, the Dog and Crusher. And that pressure that Mick is talking about, if you look at the video, if any fan, if you wanted to suspend disbelief, if any fan watching cannot see how that blood is actually jumping out of the wound. And, you know, let me tell you something, blood capsules, as people said they used, they never did, but blood capsules don't spurt at you. So, and then it was Butcher outside the ring that was putting the pressure on the wound as they hauled Crusher away, or Mad Dog away. But that was fuel. It was an accidental thing that just added fuel to the next 6 months, 8 months, and led up to another cage match around the circuit with them.
And last question here for you guys, for both of you, from Leona Martin. Wasn't there a football player that had a publicized fight in a bar with Bruiser and then they had a match?
This was in Detroit, and George alluded to how popular Bruiser was in that neck of the woods. The football player was the late Alex Karras from the Detroit Lions. And you talk about promotional genius. Alex Karras had a bar in Detroit, and they were going to set up a feud between Bruiser and Alex Karras. So Bruiser one evening enters Alex Karras's bar to pick a fight. And, you know, they brawled all over the bar. You know, I don't know how intense it was. There wasn't any TV of the incident at the time, but it made the Detroit paper. And, you know, as if it was a legitimate deal and there was legitimate heat between Karras and Dick the Bruiser. And of course, it sets up a main event, sets up a match between Bruiser and Alex Karras for the King of Detroit or whatever it was. And Alex Karras put Bruiser over in the middle of the ring, but it was promotional genius back at the time.
And what do you remember about that, George, too?
Well, that's the same thing as Mick is saying. It made the magazines, Wrestling Life and Wrestling As You Like It, had stories on this. It was their covers were devoted to the feud between Karras and the Bruiser. And so, again, promotional genius. These are the things when you sometimes bring in other celebrities from other sports, or you bring in a local celebrity and put them against a talent. Mm-hmm. You know, the fans come out to see them, and then you got them supporting both people.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're about 40 minutes into this thing. Is there anything that I missed? Is there anything that we need to add to it that we haven't covered at all? Whether it's been questions that things that you guys have wanted to bring up, or questions that maybe, you know, anecdotes that fans should know.
Just a couple of things about Crusher. George had mentioned his finishing maneuvers, the stomach claw, the Crusher Nelson. It had to be a Crusher Nelson. It wasn't just a full Nelson. It was a Crusher Nelson. Chris, you've got to know there was a difference. And of course, Crusher.
Well, there was, his fingers swelled up.
That's right. there's Crush again. And Crusher's, his final, I guess, finishing maneuver in his career was the dreaded bolo punch. Now, in theory, the bolo punch could be a pretty devastating maneuver. I mean, you know, you got a 252-pound guy, and he's unloading a fist or a forearm to a guy's chin. Instant knockout. There's no question about it. But what happened was, as Crusher's babyface run was evolving, and he became more of a kind of a cartoonish character on television, he would have a guy in position for the bowl of punch, and he'd wind up one way, and he'd wind up the other way, and go back and forth. And then he would hit him with a punch to the chest that, Chris, you could take and still stand up. One night in particular, there's a guy coming in from Canada by the name of Dave Muir, M-U-I-R.
Okay.
And they're wrestling on TV, and, of course, Crusher is going to go into the finish. Now, it was amazing because whenever Crusher was going to deliver the bolo punch, invariably his opponents were positioned just perfectly in front of him with their hands on their knees, bent over, waiting for Crusher to deliver the punch. Obviously, they were so dazed they didn't know what was going on.
It's so ironic, isn't it? So ironic.
It really is. Well, that was the magic of the hold, of the maneuver. That's how good Crusher was. But this Dave Muir, Crusher is extending the back and forth windup to the bolo for probably a half a minute. And as he's doing this, he's talking to the fans. Crusher is about Rita. What do you think of this bum? And what he's, well, Dave Muir starts laughing at the jokes that are being told at his expense. So he's in this bent over, hunched over position. Crusher's doing this and this and this. And you see Dave Muir's belly is going in and out because he's laughing. And then Crusher mercifully delivered this devastating bolo punch and put his foot on Dave Muir's chest for the pin. But, you know, in all the years I've been watching wrestling, that was probably the single most devastating maneuver I've ever seen. And when you incorporate it with the fact that the guy he was delivering it to was so out of it that he actually laughed. He didn't know what town he was in. You know, that's a hell of a deal. I mean, that's wrestling history right there.
Oh. You know, I'd like to add something about the Crusher as the years went on. You know, we've seen him as this bully heel. We've seen him as a baby face when he was still wrestling as a heel and still very, very over and doing similar things like he had done when he was a heel. But Crusher was, he was good at, as the metamorphosis took place of him getting older, less mobile in the ring, able to do less things. Crusher learned how to work with an opponent and work the fans. And the trivia question today, when you talked about throwing vegetables in the ring at Killer Kowalski in 1967 to help build their feud, this is something the Crusher did throughout the rest of his career. When he wrestled against Mad Dog Vachon in their early feud, he would come out to the ringside at the studio and had a bag of dog food in his hand, and he'd be throwing dog food in the ring at the dog. And of course, the dog would be pretending to stumble over the dog food and get mad at Crusher. And Crusher would do this against Pampero Firpo when he'd come out with a big spray gun and spray, because Firpo had bugs in his hair.
That's right.
And Crusher didn't want to wrestle him with these bugs. He called him Fuzzy. And this would irritate Firpo. Naturally, you know, you're making fun of the guy's hairdo. And then, you know, the Vachons, you showed a picture a little bit ago in the late 60s or when the Crusher and Bruiser were going against him. Crusher would bring out the rocket ship. And he says, we're going to send the Vachons to the moon. We're going to get rid of them. And when Dr. X was here, he'd bring out a duck, a squeeze toy duck, and he'd walk around the ring during the doc's matches, and he'd go quack, 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 quack. He'd call him a quack doctor. And, of course, Doc would play it up, and they'd be upset. So that was, you know, one of the things. And he's the one, Crusher, is the one that gave Bobby Heenan the weasel name, as we mentioned in a previous episode. He came out on TV when Lanza and Heenan were here and dun da dun da dun, 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 dun with a jack in the box. Pop goes the weasel. And when Chris Tolos was here, he had a corkscrew-type hold into the temple of his opponent to end it. Well, Crusher teased him by calling him Chris Noodle. And he called Hennigan Race the Dolly Sisters, Gertrude and Sylvia. You know, anything to infuriate his opponents, and he played up to it. He always had a prop with him. And that helped endear the fans to him.
Yeah.
When he was less mobile and able to do some of the things that we'd remembered the Crusher. That picture you just showed of him with the big eyes bulging out and everything, that was at the height of his heel days. And I actually got that picture from the State Fair of Minnesota at a bar that was located there. And it was hanging there, and the guy gave me the picture.
Chris, I'd like to add something about the Crusher. You know, the modern-day wrestling fan, even the ones that go back to the Hulk Hogan era, Hogan was popular. I mean, hugely popular. Biggest box office years were when Hulk Hogan was here. But comparatively to the time that the Crusher spent in the AWA, Hogan was in for a cup of coffee. He was in for a few years, tremendously popular. But I would venture to say, and this would be even above Vern Gagne, that the biggest hero in AWA wrestling history was the Crusher. Number one, in terms of longevity. And number two, every time there was a heel that was going out of control, the call always went out to the Crusher to come in and put a stop to the devastation. So the modern day wrestling fans who only got a chance to see Crusher early, you know, later on in his career, 84, 85, 86, what have you, they don't know really how over this guy was. And to Crusher's credit, he was almost 60 years old when he was feuding with Jerry Blackwell in the 1980s. And for as a demonstration of his star power, when Vince McMahon was doing his nationwide expansion, and he was kind of cherry picking the stars from all the promotions, the Crusher was one that he took. Mad Dog was another one, but he took Crusher. Crusher had been loyal to Vern for all these years. Crusher made money on this last little stint with Vince, but clearly Crusher was way past his prime. And the only reason Vince wanted to sign the Crusher was A, in the AWA cities, he would get a big pop at the box office. And B, he was taking one of Vern's stars. Crusher was still a star into the 1980s. He and Baron tag team champions way past their prime. But again, I mean, there was a by design by Vince McMahon. He took away Vern's legendary Crusher.
I would piggyback on that by saying, and I'd mentioned this earlier just a little bit, anytime the Crusher would be on one of his self-imposed vacations, Vern Gagne was arguably one of the most popular wrestlers in the AWA. But when attendance would be down a little bit or when Vern wasn't available, he would always go to the Crusher, coax him back into the ring, and then have a big program with some heel. And it was the Crusher that would bring the fans back. Yeah. So that was the star power. And the same with the Bruiser. When they'd bring him in, this was huge with the Crusher and the Bruiser. They did something other tag teams never did. When they were introduced, they would start punching each other in the corner, you know, hey, and then be punching each other. And the fans used to just adore them. So they knew how to promote them, and they knew how to work the fans. And they were popular to the very end.
All right. That being said, we've got just a couple minutes left. Before we get to the trivia, but you know what? Let's get to the trivia this week, and then let's give our shout-outs, because I know I forgot one last week, and I think we're each going to do a shout-out this week. Because
I don't understand how a guy could be making $1 million a year and forget a shout-out. I mean, seriously, George, I can't figure it out.
I forgot to write it down in Sharpie on one of my $100 bills that I've got just laying around. I'm like Scrooge McDuck back here. Okay. I mean, it's hard for me. A Sharpie, yeah. I mean, I don't put pencil on that. I mean, I Sharpie my cash.
Well, you're above a lot of people. You know, I told you some of them use crayons. So.
Yeah.
Well, he had to get that in. He had to get that one alienation shot in.
Oh,
my. You know, it's a little known fact that Crusher actually, when he was tossing vegetables at Killer Kowalski and dog food Purina at Mad, he was tossing milkshakes at George Shire as well. Oh, I don't know what the connection is there, but
you know, if you ever want me to talk about a milkshake, I'll tell you about Karch there.
Why don't you talk about it off the air?
Yeah.
All right. Let's get to the trivia question here. Mick, what do we got this week?
Well, we have a great trivia question, and it's relating to the Crusher again. Way back in the 1960s, the Crusher, of course, who had a lot of gimmick matches, he had a Missouri-style match. And actually, Crusher's opponent is the one who called for this particular type of match, where the loser had to ride out of the auditorium arena on a mule, on a jackass. That was the punishment for the loser. So I want you to tell me, who was the wrestler who came up with this Missouri-style match and, of course, lost to the Crusher and wound up riding a jackass out of the ring?
So you can email Mick at mickkarch@gmail.com or George at gshire@comcast.net by February 17th. And I got to tell you, I lived in Missouri for several years. I don't think I've ever seen a well, I've seen jackasses in Missouri, but I've never seen a mule in Missouri. So now I'm very curious. I'm gonna have to ask my in-laws if they've seen any mules in Missouri.
There you go again, questioning the validity of professional wrestling. The reason there is no...
I'm not saying there aren't jackasses in Missouri. I mean, I know there are jackasses in Missouri.
I get that. The one live mule was taken out of Missouri, brought into the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And this heel that lost the Crusher was so embarrassed and humiliated that he and the mule rode off into the sunset together. And I maybe they had kids. I don't know.
How do you know it was a female donkey?
Well, I don't know.
Well, that's a story for another day.
Yeah.
Story for another day. All right, guys, before we wrap it up. Oh, what are we going to talk about next week? I know we're kind of talking about rivalries. And again, this is a shoot. We didn't really plan this out. I know I kind of want to talk about some rivalries because you guys were talking about rivalries with like Mad Dog. And I know that we talked Vern and Larry Hennig. We want to talk rivalries next week. Maybe you just kind of go over some of the best ones in the history of the promotion.
Absolutely. They're great. We got some good ones.
Okay. Well, you know, problem solved right there. So good talk. And let's give some shout outs. Mick, why don't you go ahead and go first, and then I'll let George, and then I'll finish her up.
Shout out to my good friend of 30 some years over there in Wisconsin, Jane Amundson. She is affectionately called Jane the Brain. She was a fan going way back to the Saturday Night at Ringside days. Loyal to a fault to the wrestling business. She always came into the George's Ropers and Fridley cards for Eddie Sharkey in the PWA. And Jane has been battling some health issues for the last couple of years, but damn it, she's a trooper. She's hanging in there. And shout out to Jane the Brain.
All right, then what say you, George?
Well, I think I'm going to say hi and give a shout-out to my buddy, Gary Lodge. Let me tell you about Gary Lodge. This guy, if you sit with him for 20, 30, 40 minutes, he has the driest, greatest sense of humor, and you will be laughing the whole time. He's a great wrestling fan. Started watching very late 69, very early 70. He'd watched it before, but attending matches that time period. And he is so funny with his memories and just a great fan. He comes up with some great stories. And Gary, you're one of the good ones. I love you, man.
All right. And I am going to go to my friend, somebody that I got a chance to know when I was in Sioux Falls. And that is Skip Baszler. And some people might know him as Shayna Baszler's father. But I had a chance to know Skip when I was working at a radio station in Sioux Falls, and then as Nick Dinsmore started his, you know, Eugene, however you want to remember him, started his promotion, Midwest All Pro. I kind of helped get things rolling there, and just got a chance to know Skip, and he's a genuinely good dude. I think the world of him. He's just a fantastic guy, and always fun to talk old school wrestling. He's a big fan of the project, the program, so. Shout out to Skip, Jane, and Gary this week. And, you know, thanks for supporting the project and continue to listen. That's pretty much all I can say, right?
I want to say to Skip Baszler, too, what a guy. I mean, you're absolutely right. And, you know, Skip's on the internet at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, and he'll shoot a message my way every once in a while. And his daughter, Shayna Baszler, is the real deal. And I know how incredibly proud Skip is of his of his kid.
Yeah, I think of all of his kids and his grandkids, I see, you know, his granddaughter. You talk about being a family man. Skip Baszler, absolutely a family man. So, Skip, to you, shout out, my friend. All right, guys, that was good. Let's go ahead and bring it home. And next week, we got rivalries. And I think one we're going to have to add maybe is Shire and Karch. Is that the are we going to start with that?
We just plain don't like each other, but that, you know, it's a business. So we, you know, we do what we have to do. I just right now double checked, and my appointment to get my anti-Shire booster shot is the beginning of next week. So hopefully, you know, there's no side effects, no after effects, and I'll be good to go.
I hope it's a true booster and you have to bend over to take it. I just want to say one other thing as we close out. I know Mick and I, we've teased Chris a little bit. Chris, you know how much we value you and what you're doing for us here. And believe it, it's all in jest when we give you a hard time. Although we are a little concerned about that six-figure salary you're getting and we're not. But we need you here and we love you. And everybody needs to know that Mick and I could not do this without you.
Sorry. Chris is a phenom. He really is. And he juggles a lot of tasks and a lot of duties and wears a lot of hats, yep. Let alone having to put up with us and his cat. You know, I know the cat is a big issue for you too there, Chris.
Oh, cats.
Yeah, well, now next week we're going to have a whole cat episode.
Oh, believe me, I've talked about cats on the air, and that pisses people off. So, you know what? The more that you tell me not to talk about my cats,